Oh, hi. I didn't see you come in. I just haven't really had much of a chance to play the game for this episode, so I figured I better fire up the game on my 7800, you know, the cube. Oh, shoot, that's right. We're not talking about Qbert right now. I have the wrong game in here. Oh, man, what am I going to do? Oh, man. Hold on a sec. Hold on. Let's see. If I pop this out, and then I plug in this one. All right, let's see. Okay, this is more like it. There we go. Yeah. All right, anyway, if you don't mind, I just need to play this game. I just need to play Bonk for a little while since I didn't have a lot of time to practice it for this episode. So I'm just going to do this right now. I took a vacation, and I just haven't had a second yet to plug back my Atari 7800 until now. So here we go. And okay, so just give me a few more minutes, and I will be right with you with this episode. Well, hello, everybody. Thank you for downloading or streaming or whatever you do to this podcast. This is the Atari 7800 Homebrew Podcast, and I am your host, Sean. And first off, I just want to start with a few, I guess, disclaimers. First of all, you could probably hear in my voice, I don't really sound healthy right now. I think I have some post-nasal drip going on, but other than the way my voice sounds and maybe a little bit of coughing now and then, I actually do feel pretty good. So that's not really bothering me and obviously not preventing me from talking to you. It was kind of weird because I first got something probably about 3 weeks ago. I started feeling a little bit of, I thought was head allergies, and it was right before my wife and I left for our vacation. We went to San Diego for a few days for the first time. That was a great place to stay. Ocean Beach out there. Really, really cool. The only thing, that's just like me. I have to bring everything down. There, I do have one complaint, and that's you can't avoid cigarette smoke out there. It really got on my nerves. I could never stand this stuff. I've never smoked anything a day in my life. In fact, my lungs are very sensitive to any smoke, even if I do some charcoal grilling, which I love, by the way. As soon as I light the charcoal, I'm walking away because even just that is enough to just make me feel terrible. But yeah, it was hard to avoid cigarette smoke out there. And other than that, it was a really cool time. I can't wait to go back. While we were in Ocean Beach, something I can honestly say never really happened to me before happened. My wife and I were walking down the beach one day. We spent every day in Ocean Beach at the beach. Actually, it was literally across the street from our hotel. So we kind of got spoiled to that short walk. So we're walking down the beach and some guy approaches us and he said, "Hey, are you the surfing instructors?" I said, "What?" And the guy said, "I'm supposed to get surfing lessons. And the guy told me to show up here. Are you one of the instructors, by the way?" And I was like, no, that's the first time in my life I'd ever been mistaken for a surfing instructor." The guy said, "Yeah, I'm 56 years old. I've always wanted to learn how to surf. I figured I'd better learn now." And I was like, "Yeah, sorry, I can't help you. Believe me, you don't want to learn how to surf from me." But, and that's weird. We were not carrying a surfboard either. So if you're going to take surfing lessons, you'd think you'd want to learn from somebody with a board. But anyway, a few minutes later, a woman came up to us, roughly the same age, same thing. "Are you the surfing instructors?" I was like, "No." "Well, I was supposed to meet a surfing instructor here. I thought maybe you guys were the surfing instructors." "No." So that was bizarre. Like within minutes, two people mistook us for surfing instructors. And then we started walking back, and the original guy came up to me and said, "Hey, if anybody asks, I am a surfing instructor. That woman who came up to you before, man, she's hot. I want to see if I can maybe talk to her or something. So I'm going to go up to her and pretend I'm the surfing instructor. Don't say a word." I said, "Dude, I want nothing to do with this. None of my business. I'm not saying a word to anybody." So yeah, that was an interesting time there in San Diego. Then we spent a few days in Las Vegas. So, yeah, Las Vegas in August. That's quite an experience. And, yeah, I hear everybody's like, well, it's a dry heat. Trust me. 100 and some degree temperature is hot. It's hot and not comfortable in any level of humidity. I still had a really good time, though. My wife and I did the Neon Museum tour at night. And if you never heard of it, the Neon Museum, it's a little nonprofit, a little ways down on Las Vegas Boulevard once you get past all the casinos and all that stuff. And what they do is they basically just have a lot of old signs from almost entirely from Las Vegas, from demolished casinos and things. And there was one place, I think it's the Riviera, when they closed down, they actually donated their sign to the Neon Museum. You can see the old signs that were up and down the strip, some on Fremont Street, some in other places. And at night, they actually light some of them up and shine lights on other ones. And it's pretty cool, pretty cool. And I think that's the fourth time I did a tour at the Neon Museum. It was almost the exact same thing every time, but it is so cool that it was, that's just how cool it is that I wanted to do it again a fourth time. And the main reason we went to Vegas, and in fact, this kind of steered our direction, because my wife and I always go for a trip in the summer. And thing is, we were also considering maybe doing a road trip from Seattle to Portland and then to San Francisco. We did a Portland to San Francisco trip a few years ago. That was awesome. Awesome. But we couldn't really make up our minds. And then we found out that The Who were playing in Vegas at Caesar's Palace. And suddenly my wife said, this will be a great time to visit San Diego. We looked up the flights from San Diego to Vegas, which are usually cheap in the first place because you're only in the air for like 45 minutes. And sure enough, the flights were like dirt cheap. It was something like $30 a pop. And the hotel rooms, nobody wants to be in the desert in 100 degree weather in August. So our hotel room at the Flamingo was something like $35 a night. Even with the resort fee, it was, we were getting off like bandits on that. So that was really something. And it was really weird because we had flown out to San Diego when I was having that weird head thing. So my ears kind of got, so you know what happens? Like if you've, how when you fly or if you're driving through the mountains or something, your ears pop. Well, and then you swallow and then they come back to normal. Well, because I had some sinus problems going on, my ears wouldn't come back to normal. So for the next few days, my hearing was really bizarre. I could hear fine, but the frequencies were really, really bizarre. And it took me a few days before my hearing was fully back restored to what I'm used to. And then, of course, when we flew back from Vegas, I still had a little bit of goop in my head, but it didn't really affect me too much, thankfully. And then now I have the post-nasal drip as a result of all that. But I'm feeling better and better and better by the minute. I didn't take any more time off work or anything. I still went in. Didn't stop me from riding my bike to work a couple of times in the past week. So I guess I'm doing okay. I didn't really do a heck of a lot of video game stuff since the last time I talked to you. I do have this to say. I am happy because I found my Space Duel manual for the 7800. Oh, anyway, I said I had disclaimers. There's another disclaimer. It has been a pretty hot summer so far here in Chicago. But this week that I'm recording this, the temperature dropped. It's only been in like the low 70s. So we turned off the air conditioner. And what I usually do when I record this podcast is I record the podcast in a room in our apartment that my wife and I call the lounge. It's basically the third bedroom in our apartment. We kind of use it as a combination like office. And I have my guitars and a keyboard in here. So I use that like when I record music. My desktop computer and iMac is on here, and that's where I record this and Pie Factory podcast. And usually what I do is I close the door just so external sounds don't seep in, so I have a good clean podcast here. There's a window in here, but I keep that closed because my guitars, especially my treasured Rickenbacker 12-string, are in this room, and I don't want the weather to affect the setup and the strings and everything, so I keep the window closed, so I keep the there's not really a huge change in temperature and humidity and things. But because we finally were able to turn off the air conditioning, I want to have as much air circulating as possible. So I did keep the door open this time. So you might hear some background noises. Again, I live in Chicago, and it's a very busy city, and I live on a very busy road. So you might hear some traffic go by. If you've listened to most of the episodes of this podcast, you've probably heard a police siren or two, or an ambulance siren, because I live down the street from a fire department. So that might be happening. My dog might decide to walk back and forth. So just please forgive me for this. I just want to enjoy the circulating air as much as I also want to enjoy talking to you about some 7800 homebrews. So let's start with today's feature. And that is, of course, the Homebrew Bonk by Ken Siders. It is a 48 kilobyte game. It's based on the classic arcade game Q-Bert, which is why I had the Jeff Lee interview for the last episode, just to lead into this one. So Q-Bert was made by a company called Gottlieb. So as I like to do in these situations, I like to talk about the history of the game company. So let me talk about the history of Gottlieb. A gentleman named David Gottlieb founded D. Gottlieb & Company in 1927, and it was located at 1140 North Costner Avenue in Chicago. At first, Gottlieb produced pinball machines, much like how a lot of other video game companies started. In 1930, though, Gottlieb made a game called Baffle Ball, which was the first truly successful coin-operated pinball game, and perhaps historically, its most popular pinball game. October 1947 happens, Gottlieb releases a pinball machine called Humpty Dumpty, and Humpty Dumpty's claim to fame that it was the first pinball machine that had flippers as we know them. Basically, that's what Gottlieb did for years and years and years. They did pinball games. They did a butt ton of pinball. Butt ton, I think, is an official unit of measurement, by the way. A butt ton of pinball machines. And in the early 70s, Gottlieb packed up and left Chicago and moved to suburban Northlake at 165 Lake Street, not terribly far from O'Hare Airport, maybe a couple of miles south. Anyway, in 1976, Columbia Pictures bought Gottlieb. And as a side note, Gottlieb had made two different Close Encounters of the Third Kind pinball machines, one electromechanical and one solid state. And obviously, that was a pretty easy license to do because Gottlieb was owned by Columbia, as was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The late 70s, by the way, is when that solid-state technology I just mentioned started to appear in their pinball machines. And actually, the first pinball machines that Gottlieb put out with that solid-state technology were actually remakes of earlier titles that were simply repurposed with that newer technology. So I didn't really do a lot of research into this, but I'm guessing that Close Encounters was one of those very first ones. Going on anyway, 1980 is when Gottlieb got into the video game business. They didn't produce their own titles at first, though. In 1980, there was No Man's Land, which Gottlieb licensed from Universal, the company behind Mr. Do and I believe Ladybug. And in 1981, Gottlieb licensed New York, New York from Sigma Enterprises. Gottlieb's first well-known, completely original game was Reactor in 1982. If you've played and liked the 2600 Reactor from Parker Brothers, but you haven't played the arcade version, oh my God, it is such a big difference. The arcade game is really fantastic. But what's really significant about it is that Reactor was the first arcade video game in which the designer was actually officially credited in the game. If you heard the previous episode, the Jeff Lee interview, you heard Jeff talk about how usually designers weren't allowed to be credited. And this is a very common tale. It wasn't anything new. They weren't allowed to be credited because the bosses were afraid that their designers and programmers and artists and things would be poached. However, the designer of Reactor was a gentleman named Tim Skelly, about whom you'll hear more in the next episode. If that name sounds familiar to you, you probably recognize him from designing Ripoff and a few other titles from Cinematronics. Tim was working for Gottlieb as an independent contractor, and it was part of his contract, I believe, that allowed him to get that published credit. He had a 3-game contract with Gottlieb, so Reactor was his first one. I think the other two that he produced for Gottlieb didn't actually come out. But by far, Gottlieb's most popular game was Qbert, at least their most popular video game. Yeah, you could argue that Qbert was their most popular game, period, whether it be pinball or otherwise. But October 1982 is when Qbert came out. And the following year, Gottlieb released Mad Planets, Krull, and a licensed version of Juno First from Konami. In 1983, not terribly long after Coca-Cola bought Columbia Pictures, Gottlieb was renamed Milestar Electronics. And there's a guy named Warren Davis, who was the programmer behind Qbert and many other Gottlieb games. He joked that Milestar is rat slime spelled backwards. A true story. I saw that a blog had kind of reposted the episode with the Jeff Lee interview. It turned out it was Jeff Lee himself, and the URL on Jeff's blog actually contains rat slime in it. But anyway, under the Milestar name, the company released Mach 3, Us Versus Them, The Three Stooges, and Brides is Brides, which, by the way, despite Columbia Pictures distributing The Three Stooges, Milestar actually had to go to Mo Howard's estate and get permission to do the game. They had the distribution rights, not Columbia. But anyway, they also produced Qbert's Cubes, one of the sequels to Qbert's, and Curveball, a baseball game that is extremely rare. And there were several Milestar-produced video games that were never actually released. There was Arena, Nightmare, starting with a K, by the way, Faster, Harder, More Challenging Qbert, Screw Loose, Tiles, spelled T-Y-L-Z, Video Vince in the Game Factory, and Wiz Wars, ending with a Z, by the way. But all these games, why were they unreleased? Well, it's because a management group bought out the Milestar division of Columbia Pictures, and they decided to produce only pinball machines. They said, yep, we're going back to just pinball. These video games are not going to come out. And they produced the pinball machines using the old Gottlieb name. So basically sitting in limbo were those video games in various degrees of completion. Milestar at that point was renamed Premier Technology, which in 1989 actually did release one arcade video game under the Premier name. They called it Exterminator. And the last pinball machine that Premier produced under the Gottlieb name or under any other name was the 1996 title Barb Wire, which was based on the movie of the same title, which itself was based on a comic book. And a lot of action happening, and I mentioned the fire department. I hope everybody's okay. Let them pass. Sounds of the city, folks. So that was 1996, and the summer of that year, because of the paucity of demand for pinball machines, I love that word, paucity, Premier Technologies sold off its assets and closed down. Right now, the properties that held the Gottlieb, Milestar, and Premier names are now owned by Gottlieb Development LLC, which is located in Pelham Manor, New York. There is an exception, however, and that would be the Qbert franchise, which is owned by Columbia Pictures, which itself is owned by Sony. So, if you want permission to use Qbert in something, you have to contact the lawyers at Sony. Right now, at Gottlieb's old location in Chicago, 1140 through 1160 North Costner, did I say? Yeah. There's a company called Classic Midwest Die Mold Incorporated, which very well may have been the same tenant that's occupied that building since Gottlieb moved to Northlake. And at the old Northlake location where Gottlieb used to be, there's a logistics company called Go-To Logistics. So that's a little bit of history of Gottlieb, just a very little bit. You notice there's a huge gap where I just kind of copped out. It's because, well, I didn't find a lot of information. But if you want to go somewhere to see a lot of Gottlieb games, I recommend the Pinball Hall of Fame in Las Vegas. I was there during our trip recently that I mentioned earlier. I spent some time there. There are a lot of Gottlieb pinball machines, and actually, they also have Qbert's Cubes listed on Orcade.com, but I didn't see that there. But somebody told me that the owner of the Pinball Hall of Fame is trying to collect as many Gottlieb machines as possible. So that was interesting. It was a fun time there. If you go to the Pinball Hall of Fame, if you've never been there before, it's not the most laid out place in the world. There's not really a theme like you typically find at a normal arcade. It's basically a giant warehouse with rows and rows of pinball machines and a row or two of arcade video games. And it is completely run by volunteers, and any profits they make go straight to the Salvation Army. So if you go to the Pinball Hall of Fame, the games you pay to play, you are supporting charity, which I think is a great thing there. It's not one of those pay one fee and play all you want places. It's a pay per game place. Sounds like we got more emergency action happening outside. And let's see, I believe the video games, if I remember correctly, they were all 25 cents a pop. And the pinball machines, they were different. I think there were some that were a quarter, some that were 25, or some that were 50 or 75 cents. And some of the newer ones, like the new Stern pinball machines, like Ghostbusters and Aerosmith, those were $1 per play. And most, if not all of them, were set so that you could pay either $1 per play or prepay $2 and get 3 plays. And sorry to go off on this tangent, but they also have this amazing, rare pinball machine called the Pinball Circus. If you do a search for it online, you'll see a lot of discussion forums where people say, yeah, it's overrated. It's not that great, really. It's kind of boring. It is awesome. It is an awesome game. It's hard to describe. It's more of an upright-based pinball machine. Like, it looks more like a video arcade game than it does a pinball machine, but it is pinball, and it's got several different layers from bottom to top, and you try to basically get the ball to the uppermost layer from time to time, and every layer has its own set of flippers. It was designed by Python Angelo, who did the artwork behind Joust and a lot of other things for Williams. Pinball Circus was a Midway game. There were only two of them released, and basically because the company didn't want to go through the expense of making them, because they're very expensive to make. And somebody told me that the owner of the Pinball Hall of Fame actually was offered $150,000 for his Pinball Circus, and he turned it down. But sorry to go off on that tangent. I just had to kind of talk about that. But anyway, that's a little bit about Gottlieb. So let's talk about the game Qbert. Well, truth be told, I'm not really going to talk a lot about Qbert itself, because it is a wildly popular game. Everybody knows how to play it, I'm assuming. But basically, you control a fuzzy orange character with a large snoot who goes around a pyramid, hops on the pyramid, tries to change all the colors of the top of the tries to change all the colors on the tops of each blocks in the pyramid while avoiding various enemies. And there are flying discs in which Qbert can jump to escape from enemies. And if he lures Coily the snake off the pyramid by jumping on one of those flying discs, then he gets bonus points and blah, blah, blah. There we go. There's Qbert. Any questions? Good. But I thought it would be worth talking a little bit more about the kind of the story of Qbert in a way, like how it came about, and hopefully some explanations behind different aspects of the game. A lot of this was covered by Jeff Lee in the previous episode, but just to sum it up a little bit, I guess. The original Qbert, like I said before, was released in 1982, October, by Gottlieb, and they licensed it to Konami for Japanese distribution in February 1983. There we go. Jeffrey Lee did the graphics for the game, and he kind of came up with the initial concept of the game when he did a mock-up of a series of cubes kind of inspired by M.C. Escher, one of his favorite artists. He looked at it and he's like, let me see what happens if I turn that into a pyramid. So he edited the mock-up down to a pyramid shape, and then he came up with various characters and ideas on how they could move around the pyramid. Now, the thing is, as Jeff explained to us, even though he had game ideas, Gottlieb really didn't care. The rule at Gottlieb was, if you're the programmer, you're the one who comes up with the game ideas. So basically, if you weren't a programmer at Gottlieb, but you had some ideas for game design, you had to basically pitch your ideas to the programmers and see if they like what you had to say and see if they're willing to make it into a game. And in this case, it was Warren Davis who had to get the pitch. And it wasn't so much that Jeff approached Warren Davis. It was the other way around, actually. Warren Davis saw what Jeff was doing and said, you know what? Could I use that to practice some programming and stuff? I want to see what happens with various game mechanics and how you can move characters around. And Jeff's like, you know what? Yeah, sure. So that's how the game started. Warren worked on the programming behind it. A gentleman named David Thiel was in charge of sounds. The cabinet artwork was done by Terry Dorzaff. During the development, they were calling Qbert Cubes. Later on, during the evolution of the game, they came up with the title Snots and Boogers. I think that was Jeff Lee's idea there. And why was it called Snots and Boogers? Well, because the character, the orange character, would shoot projectiles, also known as mucus bombs, out of his nose, and that's why Qbert has a long snoot. And interestingly, the killer list of video games, also known as K-Love, actually lists Snots and Boogers as if it were produced, but I really don't think it was ever produced under that title, because I think it was still fairly early in the development of the game, before it was even anywhere near completion, that name was tossed around. Was it released as Snots and Boogers when it finally came out in the arcades? No. Why not? The reason for that is a gentleman named Howie Rubin. Howie was the boss of Jeff and Warren and David. And he came in, he said, guys, please call this game anything but Snots and Boogers. Because I have to explain to Columbia Pictures and Coca-Cola why the game is called Snots and Boogers. I don't want to have to do that. So the team kind of brainstormed at what they were going to call the game, and there were some names tossed around. Usually male names were thrown out, and for some reason, somebody said Hubert, and someone said, you know what, how about Qbert, spelled it C-U-B-E-R-T. Ron Waxman, who was another one of their bosses, I think he was one of the executives over at Gottlieb, he said, well, if we're going to call it Qbert, we better spell it differently, or else someone's going to think it's pronounced Cubbert. So what he did was he suggested changing the spelling to the letter Q and then Bert to make it a little bit more obvious as to how you're supposed to pronounce it. So that's how the name Qbert came about. One other possible name that was tossed about, though, was not so much the name of the game, but the marquee would actually have just the little swearing dialogue that Qbert had when he got hit. Somebody said, why not just call it that? Why not just put that on the marquee of the game, and that's going to be the name of the game? And then somebody else said, well, because you have to give it a pronounceable name. So they had to come up with the name, and that's when Qbert came about as a name. And there actually are some versions of the arcade game Qbert that have the original untitled marquee with the swear dialogue. I actually own a marquee from the original Qbert with the swear dialogue in it instead of the name Qbert, and Jeff Lee autographed it. If you want to see one of these things in person, if you happen to be in the Chicago area at any point, at least two arcades in that area, Galloping Ghost in Brookfield and Pixel Blast in Lyle, have a Qbert with a marquee that has the swearing dialogue instead of the Qbert name. And in both instances, they are autographed by Jeffrey Lee. Also in the game Qbert, by the way, there are green characters, Sam and Slick, and the names for those characters came about as plays on the phrase spick and span. They just changed the first one to Slick and the second one to Sam, and naming the Sam character after Sam Russo, who was also one of their co-workers at Gottlieb. And also unique in the arcade game Q-Bert that you will not find in anything other than the arcade game Q-Bert, unless you find something rigged up somehow. You may have noticed, if you ever played the arcade game Q-Bert, that when you fall off the pyramid or when Coily falls off the pyramid, you would swear you feel the machine thump. Now, when I was a 9-year-old, I thought for sure it was simply the sound effect from Coily hitting the bottom of the screen. There's a little splat sound. I thought it was just a very bassy sound that just naturally made the game vibrate. No, there's actually a pinball knocker that gets triggered when that happened. A gentleman named Ron, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but it's spelled T-I-G-H-E. He was the one who came up with that idea. But so that's something worth mentioning there in the game Q-Bert. And let me talk about something else. And if you are familiar with the arcade version of Q-Bert, then you know that when Slick and Sam and two of the other bad characters, Ugg and Wrongway, appear, there's a constant stream of gibberish coming out. Slick and Sam have the high-pitched gibberish voices, Wrongway and Ugg have the low-pitched ones. And of course, when Q-Bert gets hit by an enemy, a non-green enemy, of course, the green enemies are safe for Q-Bert to touch. But when Q-Bert gets knocked out by an enemy, of course, there's the swear dialogue balloon, and he utters some audible gibberish. Now, why do these five characters speak gibberish instead of actual language? It's because of David Thiel, who was responsible for programming the sounds, including that synthesized speech from the Voltrax SC-01 chip. Basically, he programmed it that way because he was very frustrated trying to program actual words. He had worked with that chip in the game Reactor, and he found it was a terribly difficult chip to program for. And when he tried to make it say the word bonus, the closest he could get was to make it sound like bogus. So he's like, okay, if they're making me use this chip again, then I'm just going to just program gibberish, some random phonemes into the code here. So that's why there's a lot of gibberish in the game. The only actual spoken language in the Q-Bert arcade game is from the character Q-Bert. You hear when the game starts up, if you're lucky enough to hear the game start up, like if you're in an arcade when it's just opening and the arcade owner turns on the machine, you will hear Q-Bert's voice say, "Hello, I'm turned on."
Hello, I'm turned on.
I suppose you could do that in MAME too, now that I think about it. And if you score well enough to reach the high score table at the end of the game when you enter your initials, after you're done entering the initials, of course, you hear Q-Bert say, "Bye-bye."
Bye-bye.
There were some reports back then, around 1983, 1982, when the game was new, that people swore they heard Q-Bert say some profanity. But David Thiel insists, no, that is impossible. There is no profanity programmed into the game. And I'm pretty sure he is not lying. And in fact, if you ever download the Q-Bert ROM for MAME and you download the accompanying WAV files that generate the gibberish, you will not hear any swearing in any of those individual files. So go through all of them, you will not hear it. So that's something I just wanted to talk about with Q-Bert itself, rather than talk about the gameplay, more like some things you don't normally hear when you hear about Q-Bert. So some other things worth mentioning, though, is there were some sequels to Q-Bert. There was Q-Bert's Cubes, produced under the Milestar name. And there was a Atari 2600 version of that made by Parker Brothers, I believe. And if you've never seen Q-Bert's Cubes, I think it's a fun game. I really do. It's not a pyramid-based Q-Bert game, but rather Q-Bert is on a diamond shape composed of rows of cubes. And what Q-Bert has to do is hop around that diamond and rotate the cubes so that all the colors match. It's almost like a Rubik's Cube in a way, that kind of a thing. You have to get rows of cubes in a certain alignment. You have to rotate the cubes so that they have the same colored patterns. And all that time, Q-Bert is dodging various enemies. I think they're all brand new enemies too. Love the arcade version. Hate the 2600 version, by the way. Also produced by Milestar, but never released, was Faster, Harder, More Challenging Qbert, which was basically what you think it is. I'd say it's the Pac-Man Plus equivalent to Qbert. It's exactly what that is. It's a faster version of Qbert. It's more challenging in that the flying discs are constantly moving, so you have to be careful with your timing there. They don't just stay in one place. There's also an additional character. Sometimes instead of Coily, you get a character named Qbertha, who I think is supposed to be a female character, and she hops around the maze. She has a heart above her head, basically say that's the implication that she's got the hots for Qbert and is chasing after him, so you have to avoid her. That game was never released, although I think the ROM was made public domain by the programmers. There was also a Qbert pinball machine produced by Gottlieb, and it was called Qbert's Quest. I played Qbert's Quest at the Pinball Hall of Fame, and it's not really an exciting pinball machine, but it could have been something special. It's not your typical open play field pinball machine where you're just flipping the ball around and knocking down targets and everything. The path is kind of arranged in a series of loops. It's hard to explain. The pinball machine itself was not a success. It flopped. And one of the beliefs is that it's because pinball was not in very big demand at the time, which is true. It wasn't. Video games were more the thing than pinball. But I really think a big problem with it was that it wasn't, I don't know, it just doesn't feel finished. It doesn't feel like there was a lot of follow-through involved. There's some unique features in it. Like there are two sets of flippers. There's your normal set of flippers, and then behind that set of flippers, like on the next row down, there's another set of flippers. But because of the way the paths crisscross, it's interesting in that the right flipper button controls the left flipper, and the left flipper button controls the right flipper. It's hard to describe, but I don't know. It would have been a great concept if they're a little bit more done with it. That's all I have to say about that. But so there we go. And of course, there are many home versions of Qbert. There were video game conversions of Qbert for every computer and console imaginable. The only thing I can think of off the top of my head is maybe the Vectrex didn't have one, unless there's a homebrew. If you owned a computer of any kind, you could get either an official Qbert game or a homebrew clone. I know my cousins had a homebrew clone of it called Qbic or Qbit or something. I don't remember what. It was actually a pretty good translation of it. It was on the Apple IIc, I believe. And, of course, there's Bonk on the Atari 7800. But that's kind of what I had to say about Qbert as a game and the history of Qbert. So let's talk about some other history, and that is the history of the development of Bonk on the Atari 7800. By the way, before I get into the development of Bonk, you may have noticed if you've been listening to this podcast regularly, that's a hard word, February regular. Anyway, you may have noticed that there's a lot of Atari Age emphasis, and that's simply because Atari Age, for a long time, I've been a member of it for, 16 years now, I've been on that website. That's basically the root of where most homebrews originated, in fact. So you're going to hear a lot of that throughout this podcast, obviously, and this episode is no exception. Because it was Atari Age where Bonk originated, specifically 2:04 p.m. on April 1st, 2005. Gee, does this sound like a suspicious date to you by any chance? Anyway, Albert, who owns Atari Age, he announced that a prototype of an Atari-produced Qbert for the 7800, licensed from Parker Brothers, who had the home video game cartridge rights, that prototype was found. The story that Albert told was that Kurt Vindel had found printouts of the source code. He handed them over to a software developer named Ken von Mersberger, and Ken scanned in those pages of source code and compiled the source code. And according to Albert, Ken Siders stepped in, made some tweaks to the prototype, made it presentable, made it playable, and the ROM was posted. And not only was the ROM posted, but Albert added it to the rarity guide on Atari Age as a prototype entry. The unfinished prototype had no enemies except for the red balls. A couple of hours after that original posting, there was an Atari Age user named Alan who posted that he loaded the ROM onto his Cuddle Cart, which was a rewritable 7800 cartridge, long, long out of production now. But when he ran that on his 7800, he got an April Fool's Day message, according to his post. So a couple of people questioned as to how he got an April Fool's Day message while everybody else who was using the ROM in an emulator was actually able to play the game. Alan fessed up, said he was just joking. But still, a lot of Atari Age users were confused. Was this truly an April Fool's Day prank and that the ROM was maybe actually a homebrew in progress and not really a prototype? Or maybe it was possible that the April Fool's Day prank is the claim that it's an April Fool's Day prank, meaning that the ROM is indeed an honest-to-goodness real prototype. But anyway, in the wee hours of the next day, April 2nd, Ken Siders posted a small portion of the actual source code at the request of Atari Age user Bruce Tomlin. 2:38 p.m. the same day, Albert confirms, yep, you got me, this is actually an April Fool's Day joke. In reality, this is a work-in-progress homebrew version of Qbert that Ken was working on. So that started a long discussion on Atari Age about if this game is finished and released, that maybe it should come out under a different name, because history has shown that getting the license to use the Qbert name is very difficult, and you have to have deep pockets. One of the suggestions was to call the game Beef Hop, a play on the title of Ken's other retitled arcade to 7800 homebrew conversions, Beef Drop. And there were some users who kind of half-jokingly suggested that they mash up elements of both Beef Drop and Qbert and still call it Beef Hop. Someone else suggested calling it B-Kurt, B*QERT, and Al*Bert. Thing is, Albert didn't much care for that last suggestion because, well, he said, I wasn't involved in making the game, so why use my name in it? Why not call it K-Bert after Ken Siders? Someone else suggested, hey, why not use Snots and Boogers, since that's what Qbert was originally going to be called anyway. Oh, more ambulance action. There were some other suggestions for titles such as Orange Drop, Fruit Drop, QWERTY, QWERTY, that is, Qbert, with Q actually spelled QUEUE, QErnie, so that way you could have both Qbert and QErnie, Bert and Ernie, get it? Maybe just the letter Q could be a suggestion. There were suggestions for various variations on QB. There were suggestions for Cube Hop. Harder, Faster was another suggestion. Cuber was a suggestion, C-U-B-E-R. Square Jumper, Crazy Pyramid, Block Hopper, Crazy Cubes with a Q, Cubes with a Q, Cubicus with a Q, Cubicle with a Q. Personally, my favorite suggestion out of all of them was MC Eshkin. See what they did there? One user even suggested doing what Prince would do for a time and use an unpronounced symbol. And that unpronounced symbol was simply a picture of a cube. Another user suggested holy $H !T !! See what that spells out if you type that out. And why was that user suggesting it? Well, because Qbert is foul-mouthed. We'll get back to the name suggestions in a little bit. Let's go on to some more history on the development of Bonk, resuming April 5th, 2005. An Atari Age user named JetX posted a mock-up of a potential Qbert cartridge label design, and it looked like a typical Tremel-era Atari 7800 label design. April 17th, Ken posted a tweaked version of the ROM, but didn't really give any details about what was tweaked. But judging from the reactions of various Atari Age users, the tweaks included adding the green ball and adding Coily. The green ball doesn't have any functionality at this point, though it's merely a decoration. On April 20th, Atari Age user 8-Bit Classics posted his own version of a potential label, but honestly, it wasn't really that much different from JetX's version. A few days later, April 26th, there was a new ROM posted, but the changes were all done behind the scenes, or as nothing visual changed. Basically, Ken optimized the code. The next day, there was a revised ROM posted that Ken had hoped fixed a bug involved writing a flying disc from the middle of the board, rather say from the bottom or something. I'm not quite sure what he was referring to there, but oh well. May 10th, there was a new ROM with, and I quote, a not-so-fair, annoying Sam. Oh, man. I'll tell you what. Coily and the Red Balls and Ugg and Wrong Way can kill you, but man, Sam and Slick are really atrocious enemies, and they can't kill you, but they're still probably your worst enemy. Anyway, May 11th, Trevor, who is a frequent contributor to this podcast, he posted an excerpt from an online article called Qbert, a Playeries, I think that was a typo, Playeries guide. And I'll put a link to that article in the show notes, of course. The reason that Trevor posted that excerpt was that there are a lot of details about how the artificial intelligence in the arcade Qbert works, what triggers certain enemies to come out at certain times, things like that. And Trevor thought that would help Ken Siders immensely with the development. But later on that same day, Ken released a new version of the ROM file, and this time with the first two levels different objects, such as Coily and the Red Balls, following what he called the release order of the arcade game. Basically, it was emulating the arcade game as closely as possible. Ugg and Wrong Way weren't in the game yet, so instead there were Red Balls taking their place for the time being. As you advanced to different levels, there weren't any changes in speed yet. May 13th, there were some collision detection issues fixed, and there was some level intro music added, but Ken only considered that music to be placeholder because he wasn't happy with the result. There were also some preliminary sounds added for Coily, Slick, and Sam, and of course the updated ROM was posted in that message. May 17th, another new ROM came out. And this time, the arcade release order that I mentioned before was accurate for all levels, although Ugg and Wrong Way still weren't there, and the Red Balls were still used as placeholders for them. There was now a functional green ball, and you may remember from the original arcade Qbert, if you landed on the green ball, you get a few seconds of invincibility and all the enemies freeze in place. Ugg was added on May 23rd in a new ROM, although Ken said, I still need to do some work on Ugg. Wrong Way was still missing, but there was a bug that allowed you to jump through Coily under the right circumstances, and that bug was fixed. There were also some behind-the-scenes code fixes that wouldn't affect the visualness. Is that a word, visualness, of the game? But Ken said, you know what, I may have inadvertently introduced new bugs with that, so if you find any, please let me know. There was another new ROM posted the next day, May 24th, with automatic PAL detection. So if you were in Europe, you didn't need a separate ROM anymore. It would automatically detect that you were using a European console and switch into PAL mode. May 25th, there was another new ROM, this time with Wrong Way added. And May 26th, there was yet another new ROM, which Ken said would include a first pass at independent enemy timing, which I guess means that every enemy had its own little timing routine instead of one master routine for everybody. There was also some preliminary pause button support added. On June 6th, Albert posted that he got the new issue of Retro Gamer magazine, and it had a nice write-up about the Ken Siders Qbert clone. So he scanned it and posted the article the next day, which was June 7th. And on that same day, Ken posted a new version of the ROM with an updated Ugg sprite, courtesy of Atari Age user Bakasama. He said, you know what, there still needs to be some more work done in that regard, but here it is. And also, the player now had the option of holding the joystick in normal orientation or rotating it 45 degrees. If you have the Atari 2600 version of Qbert, you know that you have to hold the joystick rotated at a 45 degree angle in order to move diagonally properly, or else if you hold it the regular way, you pull back, you pull down, Qbert actually moves lower left, I think. Truth be told, I never rotated the joystick. I just kind of learned what the directions, which way it goes. I cannot play Qbert the correct way. Even the arcade game, technically, even though you're moving the joystick in a diagonal direction, the joystick itself is rotated, so it's actually registering as a down. When you pull it down right or down left, it's actually registering as a right if you pull it down right. But anyway, I'm not going to babble on any more about that. I'm going to go on to the next day, June 8th, in which there is yet another new version of the ROM posted, and this time with a redesigned UGG, a redesigned wrong way, and a redesigned purple ball. And there are some few random fixes in there as well. June 13th, there was another new ROM with preliminary two-player support and a new sprite for Slick. And the next day, there were updated graphics for both Slick and Sam, and a couple of other graphical tweaks that kind of hybridize, if you will, Ken's own graphics and Bakasama's. On June 15th, there was a new ROM that had a couple of display issues fixed and a new player/joystick selection screen added, so Ken said. On June 16th, there was a couple of graphical fixes posted, and the player selection screen was tweaked a little bit, and there was preliminary high score cartridge support added. On June 17th, a new ROM was posted that had an animated title screen, with Qbert actually going across the screen on a flying disc. Really cool touch. June 20th, there was a ROM posted that had some tweaks to Coily, including updating the Coily graphics with Bakasama's version that both Ken and Bakasama felt matched the arcade graphics a little bit closer than before. On July 22nd, there was a new ROM posted with some graphical fixes and a new title for the game. It was now called Bonk, spelled lowercase b, lowercase o, lowercase n, capital Q. August 12th, 2006, there was another new ROM posted. Oh yeah, that July 22nd date that I mentioned, that was 2006, so a year had gone by already. But yeah, anyway, August 12th, there was a new feature added in which your score from the last game was now displayed on the title screen. Also, you could now select difficulty levels. UGG and Wrong Way now had sounds, and there are some other random tweaks here and there as well. Well, I shouldn't say random, I should say miscellaneous. August 13th, the next day, there was a high score display screen added that would only display if you were not using a high score cartridge. August 15th, 2006, a new ROM existed that now had a functional high score entry screen for people who didn't have a high score cartridge. August 18th, the ROM was posted in which now you can actually put your initials in the high score screen. However, because the programming wasn't fully there yet, no matter what your high score was, it would be ranked as 9, number 9. On August 26th, the high score rank was now properly computed, so you weren't number 9 every time, and your score and your initials would actually be stored in the high score table. The previous ROM didn't actually store the information, it would just let you enter it. On October 31st, 2006, there was a high score entry table added for Player 2, before it would only work for Player 1. There was also a bug fix that, I'm not quite sure how this worked, but apparently if you suicided Qbert immediately after you lure Coily to jump off the pyramid, you would get bonus points or something. There was some kind of bug involved there. I don't remember what, though. But November 7th, so it's a week later, there was now a separate high score screen for each difficulty level instead of just one master screen. Also, Ken fixed a bug involving leftover flying discs not being counted toward your bonus properly at the end of the level. May 21st, 2007. And yes, this is now 2007 we're talking. Oh, did I say Qbert for November 7th? Yeah, I meant Bonk, actually. If Bonk or Coily falls off the pyramid, they would actually accelerate. You'd actually see them fall faster and faster. So now there was actual gravity added to the game. And there were some cosmetic fixes done for the high score table. And of course, the ROM was posted that reflected all that. June 16th, 2007, there were updated graphics courtesy of Bakasama. Bonk and Coily were redesigned with more colors in their sprites, and there were still some bugs that needed to be fixing. For example, there were colored lines appearing above the joystick graphics in the title screen. Part of the Bonk character would flicker or completely disappear on the high score screen, and there was a graphical glitch that would happen when you would ride a flying disc, and it would happen around where the score is. But that's the latest in the development of Bonk that I have to say. Except that the game was added to the Atari Age store in either late December 2007 or early December 2008. But for what it's worth, the earliest review in the Atari Age store is from February 23rd, 2008, so we know it was available at least in February, if not sooner. And of course, Bonk has gone on to become one of the best-selling Atari 7800 titles in the Atari Age store. Now, going back to the discussion of what to call this game, keep in mind that this game and Burger Time were both called something else, basically due to legalities. Now, the reason for that is basically because I think someone posted that as long as there was 5% difference between the game and the original Qbert game or whatever other title you were talking about, as long as there was at least a 5% difference, you'd probably be in the clear. And there was a big argument over that. There were some people who were saying, no, call it Qbert. Other people saying, well, you got to call it something else. And there are still other people saying, well, it doesn't matter what you call it. If somebody wants to sue you, then you're dead meat. So there was a huge dispute over that, but I'm not going to get into the details over that. It was getting pretty controversial, sometimes downright nasty, and that I really don't like myself. But it ended up being called Bonk, lowercase b, asterisk, n, capital Q. And Ken Siders has confirmed that the game is pronounced Bonk. But anyway, let's talk about Bonk as it exists currently as a playable game. As for the game Bonk itself, what's really cool about Bonk is, remember how I talked about how in the Atari 2600 version, like, they recommend rotating the joystick? Well, the way that Bonk works is you can actually configure it so that you can either rotate your joystick 45 degrees to the right, or you could keep the joystick in normal orientation and move diagonally. If you want to change how the orientation works, you use the pause button during the game select screen. In a one-player game, if you hit the pause button, it alternates between normal and rotated mode. If you use a two-player game, then you have to keep pressing pause until you cycle through the combination that you want. Player one, normal. Player two, rotated. Player two, rotated. Player one, rotated. Whatever. You just keep hitting the pause button. The characters, by the way, have all been renamed. The main character is Bonk, obviously. The green enemies, there's Sal, and then there's Slim. And what happens is Slim and Sal will revert the cube colors to their original colors, and they are green characters, which means that Bonk can land on them and capture them and get some points. Specifically, that would be 300 points. The difference between Sal and Slim: Slim has sunglasses. Coily has been renamed Snakey. I think that's my favorite rename right there, Snakey. And just as with the previous versions of Qbert, Snakey actually hatches out of a purple ball that comes down the pyramid. There are two other purple enemies. The character that you may have known as Ugg is now called Al. I don't know if that's supposed to be a little lighthearted ribbing at the owner of Atari Age or what. And the character that used to be known as Wrong Way is now called Ick, I-C-K. And of course, you have your green balls and your red balls as well. And just like with other versions of Qbert, if you land on the green ball, you get a period of invincibility in which all the enemies on the screen freeze, and you also get 300 points, by the way. And hey, let's talk about the rest of the scoring. If you change a cube top to its target color, you get 25 points. And, by the way, that happens every time a cube reaches its target color. So, for example, in level 3, when the colors go back and forth between original color and target color, every time you change that cube to target color, you get 25 points. And something I like to do is, if I'm standing next to a flying disc and Snakey is about to come get me, while Snakey is on his way, I will jump back and forth from one cube to the other just to keep building up those 25 point increments on levels 3 and higher, just so I can boost my score a little bit. It might be frowned upon in competitive play, but hey, that's what I do. on levels in which there are intermediate colors, like levels 3 and higher, the intermediate color gets you 10 points, but I believe that only happens the first time the intermediate color happens. If you finish a level without using a flying disc, you get 50 points for each flying disc you do not use. However, though, if you lure Snakey off the pyramid by using a flying disc, you get 1,000 points. So it's actually worth more even just once to lure Snakey off the pyramid than it is to actually save the flying discs for bonuses. And that's true for all other versions of Qbert as well. If you clear level 1, round 1, you get 1,000 bonus points. If you clear level 1, round 2, you get 1,250 bonus points. And if you clear level 1, round 3, you get 1,500 bonus points. And for basically the way that goes, if you do the math, really that's 750 plus 250 points times whatever round number it is. And basically that bonus maxes out at 5,000 points. When you buy Bonk in the Atari Age store, you get a really gorgeous manual. I'm very, very impressed by the manual. The artwork is superb on there, and I have to give props to Darren Rose. I'm not sure which Atari Age user that would be, if it even is an Atari Age user, but Darren did a really amazing job with the graphics on this thing. The characters, it looks like he based the character design in the manual on the Saturday morning Qbert cartoon. Yeah, there was a Saturday morning cartoon during the golden age of video games. I think it was part of Saturday Supercade. And the thing about the Qbert cartoon is that Qbert and all his friends, it was basically like kind of a 50s, almost Grease kind of thing, in that, you know, they were dressed all 50s-ish. Coily was leader of a gang, and they were wearing all leather and stuff, and Qbert was more the jock. He had the Letterman sweater with the letter Q on it and everything. And it looks like that's what this manual was based on. But yeah, very, very, really, it's almost worth buying Bonk just for the manual. It's really that good. Also about Bonk, if you have either a save key or the Atari Vox and the save key will work for saving your scores. Having said that, though, during the development of Bonk, there was a question to Ken Siders as to whether or not he would use the Atari Vox to generate speech, and he couldn't really work it out, so there's no actual speech in the game, and the sound is all from the TS Sound. The only complaint, let me tell you something, Bonk is a fantastic homebrew. It is awesome. Highly recommend it. It is one of the top sellers in the Atari Age store for the Atari 7800. It is a near perfect conversion of the arcade Qbert. It is wonderful. I cannot say enough wonderful things about it. There's only one problem with it, and you probably know what that is, but I'm going to say it anyway. The problem I have with it is the sound, and there's not much Ken could have done with that. He was limited to using TS Sound. There's no Pokey Sound in it, but that's what we have to use, and it's still a really amazing conversion of it. And I like to acknowledge the high scores. Twin Galaxies actually does track Bonk. And you're probably saying, oh, I know where this is going, because every time there's a homebrew on Atari Age that's tracked on Twin Galaxies, you have the record. Not this time, I don't. Using Bonk's default settings, basically turn it on, start the game, Paul Zimmerman has the world record on Bonk with a score of 145,760. And that was verified May 18th, 2010. However, literally 6 years to the day, I actually had a score verified for Twin Galaxies, but it was only 52,680, way off. I gotta tell you folks, though, there was one time not too long ago when I was playing Bonk, I actually scored in the 300,000s, but I wasn't video recording it, so I couldn't submit it, and I didn't even have my Atari Vox plugged in, so my score didn't save. Oh, but man, it was awesome. I got into this zone, and let me tell you, once you reach level 5, if you've never seen level 5, you have to change the cubes to the destination color, and it takes 2 hops to do it. So you might go, the cube might start off at yellow, and then the intermediate color is green, and then the final color is blue. Well, if you hop on a cube that's already blue, it reverts to the original color, not the intermediate color like with level 4. And man, that'll really drive you nuts. But once you get into a groove, you can actually do it reasonably quickly. It's surprisingly not terribly bad once you find your groove. But man, but yeah, Paul Zimmerman, 145,760. Congratulations if you're listening. If you're not listening, then well, I can't really congratulate you because you're not going to hear this. But anyway, that's Bond. So let's turn to listener feedback about Bonk. As I usually do, I posted on Atari.io and said, hey, I'd like some feedback. What do you think about the game Bonk? And as usual, I could rely on TrekMD for a very intelligent response. He says, in 1982, Gottlieb released a game that took gamers by storm. That game was Qbert, and it was such a success that it was converted to just about every home system of the time, except the Atari 7800. Fear not, for Ken Siders did not like to see this gap in the 7800's library, and he created a faithful port of the arcade classic under the name Bonk. As in the arcade, you play the role of an orange character. I guess his name here is Bonk. Yes, it is, by the way, TrekMD. It says that in the manual. Who is on a pyramid, jumping to change the colors of the cubes on it. Of course, life is never that simple, and there are various enemies that will stop at nothing to prevent Bonk from completing his task. These enemies are purple, and they come in the shape of a snake and some hideous-looking characters that jump on the pyramid in the wrong way. These kill Bonk on contact. There are also red balls that fall down the pyramid that are deadly to touch. Green characters don't harm Bonk, but they change the cubes back to their original colors, making Bonk's task more difficult. Bonk can jump on them to kill them. A green ball freezes all enemies in place for several seconds, giving Bonk a chance to change more cubes without fear of enemies killing him. The graphics on Bonk are excellent and very close to their arcade counterparts. Sound is as good as it can be using a TIA chip. Yeah, true. And game control is responsive. Bonk has 4 different levels to choose from and offers 1 or 2 player action. And thank you very much, Bonk. Thank you, Bonk? No, thank you very much, TrekMD. And of course, thank you, Bonk, for existing, I guess. Thanks, TrekMD, for that very thoughtful feedback as the fire department rolls by once again. Something I want to address in your feedback. You talked about how there are some hideous looking characters that jump in the pyramid the wrong way. That, of course, would be Ick. And what was the other one called? Let me check the manual here. Al. Ick and Al. The equivalents of Wrong Way and Ugg, of course. And yeah, they actually start at the very bottom ends of the pyramid. And what's interesting is that if you were to rotate the pyramid so that one of their cubes was actually the top, you see that they're actually moving in a downward direction. So you can kind of predict in a way like where they're going to go next. They basically start from the bottom, work their way to the top, and they're never going to really backtrack down. It's basically they let their own version of gravity take over. So that's an interesting little mechanic there. And if we move over to Atari LBC, Atari LBC says, Qbert is one of those titles that people either love or hate. I happen to love it, and in terms of Bonk, you'll be hard-pressed to find a better-playing version on any classic system, certainly not an Atari system. The controls are extremely faithful to the arcade original and very accurate. The thing to remember about both 7800 Bonk and Qbert on the 2600 is that you must rotate your controller 45 degrees with the button facing the top. This mirrors the configuration of the arcade controller. It's awkward at first, but once you get used to it, you'll find the game is much easier. There is a normal controller mode too, but I always use the 45 degree setting. The graphics are quite nice, with the bright colors and characters of the arcade fairly represented. In between level demos and high score screen are intact. Sound is the one weak spot. Like so many other 7800 games, TIA is the Achilles heel. Qbert isn't a great sounding game to begin with. I disagree with that, Atari LBC. But in Bonk, the sound effects are even harsher. Still, it's a decent approximation of the arcade sounds, given the limitations of the system. I would love to see a pokey version. Oh my god, me too. Pros, tight control and faithful gameplay, good graphics, best version on any Atari system. Cons, TIA sound. I give it 4.75 stars. Tons of fun and a must-have for Qwert fans. Atari LBC, thank you so much for your feedback there. And the part of your feedback I want to address is when you talk about how this is the best version, certainly out of all the Atari versions. I agree with that so freaking much. I gotta tell you though, I really did like the 2600 Qwert. I got that as a Christmas. All right, I gotta tell this story. I tell the same story in the upcoming episode from Pie Factory Podcast, and I think I told this to Ferg in a listener submission I sent him when he covered Qwert for the 2600. But I have a story about this. When I was a child back in the early 80s, growing up in Bourbonnais, Illinois, my next door neighbor got an Atari 2600 a few months after I got mine. We both had small collections, but their collections were different enough that there wasn't really much overlap, so we would kind of borrow each other's games a lot. Well, my neighbor had a friend named Petrowski. I don't know what his first name was. I just knew his last name, Petrowski. And just to show you a typical Chicagoland surname, Petrowski was spelled P-I-E-T-R-A-C-Z-E-W-S-K-I, and it was pronounced Petrowski, which I guess if you're a certain Eastern European descent, that's phonetic. But anyway, my neighbor would borrow some games from Petrowski, and sometimes I would borrow those games, so it's basically like a Kevin Bacon-style version of borrowing games, I guess. Well, word got out that Petrowski got Qwert for the 2600 right when it came out, and that... You probably think of Pac-Man being a highly anticipated title, and of course the letdown when it actually came out, except I actually liked it, believe it or not. But Qwert was also a highly anticipated title. I remember very well, at least among my friends and everything, Qwert, when that was announced, everybody wanted to try Qwert. We're like, oh my God, Qwert is out. And so word got out that Petrowski had it. However, Petrowski would not let the game out of his sight. Nobody would borrow it. It would not leave his house. So that just left everybody wondering, oh my God, what's this going to be? Except people who actually went to Petrowski's house. But I never saw the game until I got it for Christmas in 1983. I asked for it for Christmas. And I was like, you know what? This isn't a perfect conversion, but given what the 2600 can do, this is still pretty good. I was very happy with it. And I seldom played with the difficulty switch over in A. I rarely opted for the red ball. But I thought despite its limitations, they did a very good job of it. But I agree with Atari LBC that the 7800 conversion bunk is the best. I did have the 5200 version of Qwert the brief time I had a 5200, and I hated it. For one thing, I had a problem with the graphics because the edges of the cubes were way too jagged. They were way too 8-bit for me. And the 7800, the Unbonk, they're a little bit jagged, but not nearly as bad as the 8-bit version. The other thing I didn't like about the 5200 version, and everybody can probably say this in unison with me, the control. If you've never played the 5200 version of Qwert, and this was true of Frogger, which was another Parker Brothers home conversion, if you wanted to move, you had to press the button before you moved, every time you moved, basically because the 5200 controller didn't center itself. So it basically allowed you to manually recenter the controller so you could move again. But I know there wasn't really a heck of a lot you could do about that. So they were programming around a pretty lousy control scheme, and that's all they could do. But I still hated it, though. But yeah, bonk. That is my favorite home conversion as well. Thanks again, Atari LBC, for your great feedback there. And on Atari Age, I heard from Gambler172, who says, Bonk is a good game for me. Not a top game, but a good one. And thank you, Walter, for that comment. Short and sweet. And for me, it definitely is a top game. It's one of my favorite of not only the homebrews, but the entire 7800 catalog, be it official or non-official. Your mileage may vary, of course, and of course I have a feeling the sound might have something to do with it, but danke, Walter. So that's episode 18 done for the Atari 7800 Homebrew Podcast. Thank you all for listening and allowing this nasally drippy voice to come into your audio device, whatever that may be. And of course, I also want to thank the following people who have generously supported this podcast financially via patreon.com. Thank you so much to the following people: Gray Defender, Ed Ladin Controllers, Kyle Etter, Jimmy G, Richard Grounds, and Richard Valdez. You're all awesome. Thank you. If you wish to contact me, you can email me at homebrew78@fab4it.com. That's F-A-B, the number 4it.com. Show notes page is the exact same thing, except with a dot instead of an at. So homebrew78.fab4it.com. And you can also download this and past episodes from there. My Twitter handle is homebrew78. And my YouTube channel is homebrew7800. And, that's right. I still have to remind you, there is a contest going on right now that is kind of related to both this episode and the next episode being about Armor Attack 2. The prize is Mark Oberhäuser's Armor Attack box work. And by the way, I should also add that this is not the same Armor Attack box that you get if you order Armor Attack with a box. This is a different design, actually, from Mark Oberhäuser. It doesn't actually say Armor Attack 2, it says Armor Attack. And by the way, Mark also designed a box for Bonk, except it says Qbert instead of Bonk. But I'll put a link to Mark Oberhäuser's site in the show notes. But if you would like this fresh Armor Attack box for the Atari 7800, then I need you to contact me with the answer to the following question. At the end of this podcast's theme music, the thing where you hear nothing but the 12-string, that is based on A Hard Day's Night by the Beatles. However, though, the notes that I am playing, I'm playing an actual melody on that guitar, and I need you to tell me where that melody comes from. Already had a guess that it was from the Qbert Saturday morning cartoon. No, it's not. I can also tell you this much. It is not from the arcade game Qbert, but it is Qbert related. And it's actually taken from a version of Qbert that you can play on your Atari 7800. So think about that one for a little bit and ponder that and contact me with the answer. Tell me where it's from and be as specific as you can. And I will send you this wonderful Armor Attack box for the 7800. And if we have multiple correct answers, there will be some kind of a raffle among the correct answers. So the winner will be announced on the next episode when we talk about Armor Attack 2. So once again, everybody, thank you very, very much for listening. And please give these hardworking homebrew developers the support they deserve. And please give victims of Hurricane Harvey the support that they need. You'll notice I didn't give out the Patreon link for this podcast. And seriously, right now, if you have a few bucks to spare, I'd much rather it go to people who really, truly need it a lot more than this podcast needs it. So there will be a link to the Red Cross where you can donate to help Hurricane Harvey victims. I'll put that in the show notes. So I hope people in Texas are either doing okay or are on their way to being okay. God bless all of you. And those of you listening, thank you so much for listening. Talk to you again soon.
Ho, ho, ho! Happy Easter! Here are 7,800 Easter eggs for your Easter enjoyment. Now be good, boys and girls, and don't listen to these unless you want spoilers. Ho, ho, ho! Happy Easter!
And guess what? There are Easter eggs, multiple Easter eggs in the game Bonk. Now, remember how I said there was a heated debate over legalities of the game and changing the name? Well, after Ken announced that the name of the game would be Bonk, there was, Sean Sr., for one, on Atari Age, was very vocal about not changing the name, and he commented, Qbert 7800, April 3rd, 2005 to July 22nd, 2006, RIP. Atari Boy 2600 also chimed in about how the game should be called Qbert. In response to that, though, Ken commented, and I quote, But if you pause to think about it and do the right thing, the old title could return. And indeed, somebody found the Easter egg and posted a picture of it. I believe you need to have the Atari Vox attached to do this, though. Hence the do the right thing, because you put the Atari Vox in the right controller port. I haven't done this Easter egg yet, but what happens is, if you hit the pause button during the right moment with the Atari Vox attached, the title screen actually says Qbert instead of Bonk. There's another Easter egg. Trevor said, also try finishing in last place a few times with a save key or Atari Vox attached for some more Easter egg goodness. I'm going to be quite honest with you. I don't know what that is about. I haven't tried it yet, but that is there for you to try. And the third Easter egg that at least I know about, here's something that Ken said. I think it was, or was it Trevor? It was either Ken or Trevor. I think it was Ken. But the actual quote is, and I quote, when you are turning the 7800 on, if you pause to think about it a little, then once you start a game, if you do the right thing, it should not be difficult to make a change. Well, what happens? Well, Snakey actually becomes a character named Alberta, which is an homage to Qbertha from Faster, Harder, More Challenging Qbert. So there we go. We got some Easter eggs for Bonk. And what more can I say? Thank you again for listening, everybody. Toodles.